time for a first look at what it says in this Friday morning's newspapers with Fiona Kelly.
Vulnerable, betrayed once again. That's the headline over the lead editorial in today's Irish Examiner. That paper in the Irish Times also lead this morning with the findings of Ian Elliott's report into sexual abuse in scouting. Both papers highlight its conclusion that sexual abuse was tolerated at the highest levels of former scouting organisations, and that there is evidence that groups of sex offenders operated at the top of those organisations to protect each other and to facilitate child abuse. Under the headline, Scouts Scandal, a Lesson for All Volunteer Institutions, the Irish Independent also devotes its lead editorial to the findings of that report this morning. For its lead story, the paper outlines details of phase one of the plan to reopen the country, which begins next Monday, which is also the day that Stormont has announced that Northern Ireland will also start easing its restrictions. The lead headline in today's Irish News references Deputy First Minister Michelle O'Neill's description of next week's move towards step one of their exit plan as baby steps. Details of the investigation into whether all hospitals have fully reported cases of COVID-19 after it emerged that one hospital reported hundreds of cases late generates the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mail. In its version of this story, and its front page today, the Times reports that the number of cases in question accounted for more than half of the 426 new cases reported yesterday, while the Mail puts the number at almost 300. The piece in the front of the Times also reports that private hospitals may pull out of the agreement, which has seen the state take over their facilities during the COVID-19 crisis, if the HSE doesn't increase the number of patients it's sending to them. We're told that a group of private consultants who have not signed a state contract maintained that across the private hospitals on Tuesday, occupancy levels were at 34% and that some of those hospitals had no inpatients. The Belfast Telegraph leads today with the line that the families of people in care homes in Northern Ireland are threatening legal action unless there is a public inquiry into the handling of the COVID-19 crisis. Restaurateur Ronan Ryan and his wife, former Miss Ireland Pamela Flood, are pictured in the front of both The Independent and Herald this morning. And the Herald leads with their deal with Tanager, which will wipe out the €1.2 million they owe and allow them to sell their house in Clontarf and buy a smaller family home. Also in the front of The Independent, there's a report there on the Sisters of Charity's handover of land to the state, valued at €200 million at St Vince's Hospital and St Michael's Hospital in Dublin for the nominal sum of €1. Back in the front of The Examiner, there's a picture of friends and neighbours lining the streets of Blackpool in Cork yesterday, alongside saluting Gardaí, following the funeral of 12-year-old Abby McGough, who died in Cork University Hospital this week. Abby had battled a form of cerebral palsy all her life, and following the Abby's Wish to Walk fundraising campaign a few years ago, she travelled to the US to receive specialist surgery. Salute to Abby, and a life of love and laughter is a headline over that story this morning. And finally, the Mail runs with a front page story on the success of Normal People. We're told that the television drama, adapted from Sally Rooney's novel, has been streamed 1.1 million times on the RTE player and 16.2 million times in its first week on the BBC iPlayer.
7 weeks ago, Friday, March the 27th, the Taoiseach announced the shutdown which we've all been living with since. Later today, the Cabinet will meet and is expected to agree to the first phase of easing those restrictions from Monday. Throughout this morning's programme, we will hear from businesses and workers as they prepare to return to work. We will also speak to the Finance Minister about the reopening. Meanwhile, another 10 families are grieving this morning. 1,506 people with COVID-19 have now died here. 426 more cases of the virus were confirmed yesterday, bringing that total to 23,827. Jill Steadman reports now from last night's department briefing and explains that large number of new cases.
426 new cases of COVID-19 were announced yesterday. While that may seem like an increase on recent trends, the Chief Medical Officer explained that is not the case.
There has been a reporting of one large number of cases that accumulated over a period of time, diagnosed in respect of one specific hospital and reported by the Occupational Health Department of that hospital.
Dr. Tony Houlihan said one hospital was late in their reporting of over 200 cases.
You'll see those cases represented over a period of time that go right back to the middle of March, small numbers of cases each day, and never getting above 10 or so in a given day over that extended time period. They were accumulated, we weren't aware of them, and they were reported in one group today.
When asked if contact tracing had been carried out in those cases, he simply said,
I don't know, but I am saying that there would still be, it wouldn't surprise me if there had been contact tracing, because the knowledge of these cases would have been in the hospital. Contact tracing in hospitals usually is done by the occupational health teams within those hospitals.
On a positive note, the latest data shows that the spread of COVID-19 is slowing. Professor Philip Nolan, chair of the NPHET Epidemiological Modelling Group, went through the figures.
So in the middle of April, on average, we were reporting close to 600 new cases per day. That had declined by last week to under 300. And as of yesterday, looking back over the preceding 5 days, on average, we were looking at 172 new cases. And what you might call the true new cases today remains in line with that.
Professor Nolan confirmed that the number of patients in intensive care units is also falling.
You're all utterly familiar with the fact that we had very large numbers of people in intensive care in mid-April, on average 140, down to a little bit under 100 last week, down to 69 on average over this week, and that number is 58 as of this morning.
While this all sounds like good news, Professor Nolan urged caution.
We do remain, of course, should reproduction number rise, at risk, a very significant risk of a second wave. So how people behave over the coming weeks is going to be really very important.
Questions were asked about the outbreaks in nursing homes and whether action should have been taken sooner. Dr. Houlihan had this to say.
The restriction of visitors from nursing homes is very, in particular, a difficult one, because it's cutting off loved ones from visiting their relatives in nursing home environments. And that was among a large range of measures that we did not want to introduce before we believed that we were at the point at which they were necessary.
In terms of reported tensions between the HSC and NPHET over testing capacity, Dr. Colm Henry, the HSC's chief clinical officer, had this to say.
In such an environment, it would be implausible for me to say there are no tensions and there's no exchange of frustrations. But that, to me, the end point of all this is we work together and we sort things out. And that's what's happened in this testing regime. We have a completely agreed position. We now are in a happier position than we were with testing a month ago, in that we have not just capacity, but we've got capability to address turnaround times in a much more meaningful time frame than we were in even a couple of weeks back.
Those sentiments echoed by Dr. Houlihan.
That if I told you there was no tension, maybe we wouldn't be pushing ourselves hard enough to try and do the job we're trying to do.
So will NPHET be advising the government to begin easing restrictions next week? Dr. Houlihan didn't quite answer that question.
Do you want to tell us what NPHET is telling the government on restrictions?
I'm not in a position to do that, and I know you understand that, Shane. We've given advice today to government, and government has a scheduled cabinet meeting tomorrow to consider that advice.
His lips are sealed for now. That's the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, taking questions from journalists at the Department of Health briefing last night, ending that report by Jill Steadman.
Tony Houlihan, understandably, they're being coy about answering the question, what did they recommend to the government? And I suppose answering, perhaps helping us to answer the question, what is the government likely to decide today? But you're reporting this morning that the cabinet is expected to sign off now on this phase one of the easing of the COVID-19 restrictions.
Yeah, certainly every indication coming from government buildings is that it's going to proceed along expected lines. And I suppose that tallies with what the Taoiseach spoke about in the Dáil yesterday too, when he said he was increasingly confident of that. So you're looking at what is still a fairly modest easing of restrictions. That is that certain shops can reopen, primarily those that have an outdoor focus in them, like garden centres, farmers markets, but also hardware stores, homeware stores. And some of those shops that were allowed stay open at the beginning of this crisis, like bike repair shops, motor repair garages, IT and phone repair shops, can reopen as well. And I suppose from an employment point of view, the big thing is that construction workers should be able to return to work on Monday. Also, garden workers, those working outside and those working on allotments, will also have permission to do so if, as expected, Cabinet at some point this morning agrees and moves forward. Another point too that the Taoiseach spoke about yesterday is the whole issue of what he termed face coverings rather than face masks, that some advice on that should become clearer as well today.
We heard Tony Holohan there responding to questions about tensions between his committee, NPHET, and the HSE, but some evidence of tensions between those public health officials and the government, although thus far the government has been taking the advice they give and acting on that advice.
I suppose that has been apparent now for the last fortnight, that it was always going to come to pass that political needs and political will was going to collide with health advice. And some evidence of that, I suppose, again, during the week when the Taoiseach said one of the safest things that one could do would be to reopen schools, basing that on the analysis carried out in particular by HICWA and also the World Health Organization and conversations the government had with that organization. But Tony Holohan, keen earlier in the week to clamp down on any speculation that schools might be reopening before September. So I suppose that tension does exist. It has existed for a while now, especially at cabinet level. Some ministers particularly vocal on the need to move quicker. What's going to happen today probably for the moment is sufficient. That tension that we saw within the wider administrative system, I suppose, evident yesterday in the publication of those letters that showed that Paul Reid, the HSE boss, certainly at one point in the middle of April, was unhappy that NPHET were making promises that capacity to go up to 100,000 tests per week could be achieved quickly.
Some relief financially in terms of the public finances, with many workers in construction and parts of retail getting back to work today. That'll relieve some of the financial strains which this has imposed. But those financial pressures, very much the backdrop for the continuing talks, day five today, between Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens on possible government formation.
Yeah, they are. And I mean, there's key components of that will be to the fore again today, because I think Brexit will be on the agenda this morning. And again, it's looking at a deficit for the end of year that could run to 30 billion that is focusing minds. But I think overall, you are going into day five of substantial talks. As I understand it, there isn't yet that huge necessary urgency that veterans of this experience say would be needed to kind of propel these talks to reaching an agreement soon. And I suppose what's required there is that large sections of texts are agreed and signed off on, that nothing akin to that has happened yet. However, there were signals last night that those talks will intensify fairly considerably next Monday and that is necessary. But I suppose at the very least, that is still a long way off a final agreement, and you could be talking probably a fortnight before anything along those lines will take shape.
The briefing that Pascal Donoghue gave this week that was reported on, Micheál, what was the impact of that on the talks and the mood of the talks and the attitude of the parties towards what might face them, and were they to at the end of this process end up in government together?
I think it does focus minds in the sense that it limits the possibilities that are there, and it also shows that the huge task that will face any new government will be around getting those public finances in order, and it's something they can't exactly get a measure on at the moment. So a government that takes over will be an unpopular one, and finding ways of channeling parties' priorities into that programme for government becomes all the more difficult for that. That realisation is there, and if anything is to happen along those lines, issues that are particularly important to parties, many of them will have to wait until the latter part of the lifetime of the next government, if it makes it to that, possibly years 3, 4 and 5. The immediate task will be a daunting one. They are clear on that, but actually what Pascal Donoghue said to them, what that means to the text of any agreement, nothing like that has come to pass yet, although minds are beginning to focus.
And the assertion that the financial implications, the public finance implications of this can be managed without recourse to tax increases in the years ahead. I mean, how plausible is that regarded?
It seems to remain something that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are sticking by. And we know that because of the correspondence that they sent to the Labour Party earlier this week, that one of the questions asked by Labour, and they're sticking to it, believing that any moves around increasing taxation, whether it's income tax or corporation tax, at a time when they're trying to stimulate growth in the economy and attract investment, they think would be detrimental. But of course, it is a particular challenge, and it inevitably then brings the focus back on cuts that will have to be found elsewhere. The government, the outgoing government, and indeed the correspondence and documentation that exists between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael at the moment are far more vague on that particular point, saying when it comes to budget time, all spending, obviously enough, is reviewed. And I suppose that suggests that you could see some drastic cuts. There's always a possibility of that, even if the message is being put out too, that borrowing for the moment remains the key to getting out of this particular financial crisis.
Very good. Political correspondent Micheál Lehane, thank you for that. At the time, 25 past seven.
At the start of this pandemic, the HSE took over the running of private hospitals for 3 months in order to be best prepared for any surge in COVID-19 patients. However, not all the consultants who work in private medicine agreed to sign contracts to work in the public service for the duration of the emergency. They said they were angry about not being able to continue to treat their private patients. Now, the State Claims Agency has written to the country's histopathologist, telling them not to accept biopsies from these consultants, who are thought to number around 300. Histopathologists are doctors who examine tissues and cells to diagnose disease. We are joined by the Fianna Fáil's health spokesman, Stephen Donnelly. Stephen Donnelly, good morning.
Morning, Audrey.
And you're welcome. This is to do with indemnity, isn't it? Is the State's Claim Agency saying that those histopathologists who examine a sample which is sent by a consultant who hasn't signed the public contract won't be indemnified?
That seems to be the case, and therefore they can't do the work. So what we're looking at is women with cervical cancer having that cervical cancer remain undiagnosed and therefore untreated with all of the potential health implications of that. Because
well,
of this
position. Why does it mean that specifically?
So at the moment, there's about half the private consultants feel they have not been able to sign up to the Type A contract. Partly there are worries about whether or not they are insured when they're working in their rooms, which are off campus, partly because a lot of them have operating costs which are not covered by the state, which are well in excess of the salary. And so they haven't been able to do it. Now, some of those doctors are still working voluntarily, and this applies to them. So you will have colposcopists, for example, which are gynecologists specializing in cancer. They have women referred to them by GPs who might have high-grade abnormalities flagged by cervical check. So they meet the woman and they send in a biopsy to check. This is the normal procedure. What the State Claims Agency has now said is when you, to the histopathologists, you are not to process these biopsies. So the two main areas I'm told this will affect at the moment are skin cancer and cervical cancer, because those biopsies can be taken in the doctor's rooms. The same private consultants currently are essentially locked out of the operating theatres where they would take other biopsies. So, for example, okay, if a man had suspected prostate cancer.
Okay, but is there not a way around this? Because many more consultants have signed the public contract, and many consultants are still continuing to do both private and public work.
Well, there's no private consultants continuing to do both private and public work.
No, but public consultants are.
Perversely, it's just public consultants who can now do private work. There may not be. So it may take time for the state to say, okay, we are going to cover your costs. It may take time for the state to say, we will provide you with indemnity when you're working in your private rooms, which aren't on the grounds of the private hospitals. So far, the state appears to have dug its heels in and pretty much said no. Certainly, there's plenty of consultants I've spoken to who, while not enamoured with the A contract, would sign it. But what they're saying is, look, their post-tax salary on the A contract, let's say, is 100,000. They're saying my costs for running the show are 600,000. So, you know, I can't pay 600,000 in cost with a 100,000 euro salary. But in the meantime, while this standoff is happening and while the state seems to be digging its heels in, we potentially have women who are going to die of cervical cancer because the state is stepping in and saying their biopsies are not to be tested. Given that, in and of itself, I think is a very serious situation. The same applies to people with suspected skin cancer who've had the biopsies taken by the consultants. That in and of itself is extraordinary. For it to happen, Audrey, a year after we have stopped meeting to talk about the cervical cancer crisis, it really justifies belief. So what we want now is we want the minister and possibly the Taoiseach to step in immediately and say, without prejudice to the current standoff with the Type A contract, we must process biopsies that are being sent in. These are biopsies that are being sent in by cancer specialists who believe that their patients may have cancer. We cannot have a situation where the state says, for administrative reasons or because of negotiations, we are not going to process these. Because the implications for the patient, Audrey, is this. The consultant will have to go back to their patient and say, I'm sorry, I can't get your biopsy tested. The patient then has to go back to their GP and be referred to another consultant. They then have to wait God knows how long to see that consultant. They might need to see that consultant more than once before the consultant can take a biopsy. And who knows what damage is being done to the patient while all of that delay is going on.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning and bringing that to our attention. Fianna Fáil's health spokesman, Stephen Donnelly. It's 7:30.
China's factory output rose for the first time this year as the world's second largest economy slowly emerged from lockdown. Industrial production climbed almost 4% in April. The production of oil, coal, metals and electricity all increased as plants restarted operations. Back home, consumers are more likely to continue shopping online for clothes, toys and electronic goods after COVID restrictions have been lifted. That's according to a new national survey conducted by Banking and Payment Federation Ireland. It found that people shopping for groceries, hardware and DIY products, as well as newspapers and magazines, are less likely to do so online once the restrictions are eased. The head of the World Trade Organization has said he will step down a year earlier than planned. Roberto Azevedo's surprise departure comes as the WTO faces the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. He said an early change of leadership would help the organization face new post-COVID realities. On the currencies, €1 buys 88.5 pence sterling and $1 8 cents.
The SIPTU trade union is calling for urgent action to be taken to deal with clusters of COVID-19 infections in meat plants here. The Doyle heard yesterday that there have been 600 confirmed cases of the infection in workers in meat processing factories. Jerry McCormick is Deputy General Secretary of SIPTU and he joins us now on the line. A very good morning to you, Jerry McCormick. This, I think, is something that you've been drawing attention to, or trying to draw attention to, for some weeks, concern over working conditions in some of our meat processing plants. And the number of infections that have arisen. These latest figures, what's your reaction?
Yeah, good morning, Brian. Yes, we have indeed. Could I just first make a quick point? I want to express condolences, firstly, from our union on behalf of the 1,500 citizens of this country who've died as a result of the COVID-19. And I also want to acknowledge the huge work that workers have been doing since this healthcare crisis has occurred. And keeping this country going, particularly our healthcare workers, support workers, private and public sector workers. And I want to acknowledge we had news yesterday that seven healthcare workers have now died as a result of COVID-19. Indeed, two of them have been members of our union. So we want to express our condolences to all of those heartfelt thanks to all of those who have been working.
Yeah, it's also
just in relation to the meat industry.
They are, I mean, the meat workers, I mean, the point, we should make the point, and you make it there in relation to health workers, they are essential workers. They're doing work that we need. We need the food, the shelves to keep stocked.
Yes, absolutely. It is an essential industry. There's no doubt about that. The problem that has occurred really is that when this crisis began first, many plants and operations were given guidelines from the HSE on how to operate. There was no protocol in place at the time. So a lot of employers, indeed some of them, it's questionable as to whether they should have opened at all or not. They were calling themselves essential, but in reality, a lot of them weren't. But dealing with specifically with the meat industry, you are right, it is an essential service that needs to be provided. It provides food, not only just for this country, it also provides food for other European countries as well. And what seems to have happened is that some employers really didn't take this serious. Some of them did. Some employers ignored completely the recommendations from the HSE on how to do physical distancing and put in proper processes to protect workers. And what seems to have happened is that quite a few workers have got infected in this industry. If you contrast, for example, the meat industry with the dairy industry, both providing food throughout this country and abroad, and we have very little, if any, outbreaks in the dairy industry. It's a well-paid, well-regulated industry compared to the meat industry. So we had a problem. We had a problem from the very beginning. We had this problem that some employers weren't taking this serious.
Now, but there's also, Jerry, can I just come in? Yeah. There's also an aspect here that a lot of these workers are, I think the vast majority are migrant workers. They're coming from outside the country.
I'm just going to get to that point.
And they're also living very often in what might be crowded conditions.
Yes, of course. I was just going to get to that point. The demographics of the employment are completely different as well, not just the terms and conditions of employment, but in some plants, 70 to 80 to 90% of the workers are migrant workers. Now, there is also this problem that we have migrant workers living in houses together, cohabiting with groups of other workers going into the plant. Some of them are afraid to say that they have problems. Some of them are afraid to say they are sick. And what we also have is, during last year, this government allowed thousands of workers to be granted permits to enter this country to work in this industry. Thousands of them. Now, we have always said that shouldn't have happened.
Okay.
Because that...
Yeah, sorry, I'm sorry to cut across you. Just we're a little bit tight on time this morning. I think this is something we will try and come back to and tease out a little bit in the period ahead. But for the moment, thank you for talking to us. That's Jerry McCormick from the SIPTU Trade Union at 7:40.
The retail sector, one of the hardest hit sectors of this pandemic. Over 100,000 workers are expected to lose their jobs, according to Retail Ireland, which represents 1,600 employers. Its CEO is David Fitzsimons. David, these 1,600 businesses, they employ 110,000 people. They won't all lose their jobs, will they?
Good morning. It's actually Retail Excellence Ireland. Yeah, look, we're speaking to... many employers in retail, best case, most employers as they reopen over the coming weeks will bring back approximately 70% of all colleagues. Obviously, other sectors within retail, such as tourism facing, they're planning to shutter until next year. And then if you go upstream and look at suppliers into the industry in terms of store fitting and packaging and the like, they're also going to curtail employment. So, yeah, we're trying to put some numbers on it, but it's not great. It's a six-figure sum, and we need our government support.
How many of your members can reopen on Monday?
We've about 1,500 to 1,800 stores that'll open. They're all excited. They're somewhat nervous. They're all expecting customers to respond positively and professionally. I suppose phase two, which is the 8th of June, is the big phase for retail, which is about 18,000 small stores. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how the guys get on Monday, see what demand is like. It's likely to be good in terms of lots of pent-up demand, but the concern is phase two across Europe and Asia in terms of demand is once that pent-up spend is gone, we then revert to about -20 to -40% in terms of consumer spending. Worst, again, is visitor tourism orientated locations such as towns and villages that depend on tourism in Venice and Florence and places like that. They're now at about -60 because everyone's lost their job. So
how changed will shopping be after this, David? What will our experience as customers be like?
Well, the most popular hobby in the world is shopping.
For some.
People come together, they enjoy an afternoon out in Dundrum or Kildare Village or whatnot. That's all gone. It's no longer going to be tactile and social and experiential. It's going to be very functional. We're going to actively discourage customers from browsing and touching product. It's going to be pretty horrible. And look, this is self-inflicted. We're doing this to abide by the rules and to keep everyone safe. So for the time being, the most popular hobby in the world is being postponed. And
Will there be temperature checks and the like? And will shops have to momentarily close in order to clean and to steam, say, items of jewellery, for example, that people might be trying on?
Yeah, we're anything that's tried but not bought will be disinfected and put back on the shelf. Venues are looking at thermal imaging. We're looking at queue management systems whereby you're given a reservation time and an appointment time instead of just standing out in the rain. So it's all going to change. We're in for a tough old period, and we need our government support. Every country in Europe and the world has rates measures, has rent measures, has liquidity measures. We're in the quartile, the bottom quartile, quartile four at the moment when you profile government support across the world. I'm not going to criticise the government. They've done a great job from a healthcare perspective, but economically, the supports are not there, and people are deciding today to close for good, yeah. And we need their help.
Well, David, we have to leave it there. I do know that you have a 3 months rates waiver, but you think it needs to be longer than that. We'll get into that over the days and weeks ahead. I'm afraid we have to leave it there,
Mayo,
David. We're right up against the clock. Thank you very much indeed. The CEO of Retail Excellence Ireland, David Fitzsimon, 7:44.
Construction sites closed for the last 2 months are also expected to get the go-ahead to reopen from Monday. Michael O'Flynn is chairman of the construction firm The O'Flynn Group, which employs around 500 workers on sites in Dublin and Cork, and he joins us on the line now. Very good morning to you, Michael O'Flynn. Thanks for taking our call this morning. So how are you preparing for the reopening of your sites from Monday if this phase one of the reopening gets the go-ahead from the government today?
Well, we've had an extensive retraining of how we operate on site. We've had to do induction plans with all the employees through the CIF program. We've also had to rethink our whole operation in terms of building and how we did things previously. Now, before the lockdown, we had actually implemented a lot of changes, so it's not that we're going back starting from scratch, so to speak. I mean, we've had a lot of this already implemented before the government guidelines came out during the lockdown period.
Yeah, obviously, the go-ahead at this stage is apparently coming because this is an outdoor activity, obviously, and that very considerably, we're told, reduces risk. But actually, on-site, is it possible to maintain that physical distance, which we're told is so important?
Well, I believe it is. We are going to have to do things differently. We're going to have to make changes, and we have done a plan. All construction companies like ours have had to look seriously at what are you trying to do. Some outdoor activities on housing sites are much easier to implement. Where it comes to apartment development and more intensive construction sites on bigger or even some smaller, it's a different challenge. Yeah. But I believe it is. The productivity will be different, and the cost base obviously will change somewhat. So yes, other countries didn't actually close housing, for example. We have closed it. We accept the health priority that's there. But, it's a time, it's a question of balance, and we welcome the fact that we're back next week, and hopefully that will continue as announced by the Taoiseach recently.
Yeah. I suppose it's one thing to have a set of rules and regulations, it's another thing to make sure that they're abided by. Will you also have procedures in place to monitor and enforce the rules to ensure that people are actually sticking to what's required of them?
No, that's a good question. Obviously, there's a huge onus on workers to have the discipline to adhere to the rules that have been set out. I have to say, even before we closed down, we found a very willing workforce. People are worried about their own health, and people have a discipline in relation to how they behave and how others behave. And I absolutely take your point. I mean, rules are only as good as how they're implemented. I'm very confident that we will have COVID marshals, we call them, on all sites, and compliance. Every site has been assessed separately. Every site will have a compliance officer, and we have strict rules around entrance, around meal times, around how you come and how you go. That's all different to what it used to be. Mm-hmm. So every aspect of the operation has had to be relooked at and a system found to make it safe, because we have to make it safe.
Yeah, when you say how workers come and go from sites, and people might be familiar with subcontractors arriving, several of them in a minibus together, will that be allowed? Can you stop that?
Well, we can, because we have to be strict in terms of how people come and go. I know I've heard the slogan "One Man, One Van" come out from the CIF recently. We have to insist that people arrive safely. And if there's a van and if two can go in a safe distance situation, fine. But I can assure you, it's probably slightly different in some parts of Ireland, in that we don't have the public transport issues maybe that they have in large cities. But having said that, I would have to say that how people come and go and what they do at mealtime is an essential component of implementing the safe guidelines that have been set out by the department.
And just a final question about cost. You say this is likely to reduce productivity. That will add to cost. What I mean, is there a way to quantify that at this stage?
Well, I think housing impact will be quite low, subject to a proper system being worked out. I think initially it'll be higher, but once we get into the system, it'll be somewhat lower. I think you could be in the 10% plus bracket, but I think for housing, for apartment and other types of construction, whilst this virus lasts and before we have any vaccine or one social distancing must be applied rigidly, I think the impact will be much higher than that.
Michael O'Flynn, CEO of the Flynn Group, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Petula is back with more business news.
Thanks, Audrey. Irish hotels are preparing for life after lockdown. They're scheduled to reopen on July 20th, according to the government's roadmap for recovery. Fáilte Ireland, in collaboration with the Irish Hotels Federation, has proposed a set of health and safety guidelines that hoteliers can apply when they reopen. I visited Fitzgerald's Woodlands House Hotel in Adair, County Limerick, where I met Elena Fitzgerald Kane, president of the Irish Hotels Federation, to hear about the challenges ahead.
Welcome.
I can't shake your hands.
New protocols mean a stay in an Irish hotel like this one will be different from before.
There's a huge lack of clarity in terms of the government phases, you know, restaurants and cafes on the 29th of June, 20th of July, small gatherings, hotels allowed to reopen, 10th of August, larger gatherings and other facilities in terms of leisure. And I can understand why government didn't want to give the detail on those, because they need to be reassured with guidelines. And indeed, we need to reassure ourselves as a tourism community and our teams, and that there's an understanding of what's expected. For us, I suppose the WHO recommendation of 1 metre is a huge, huge part of this. As we stand here in the lobby, right, and as you stand 2 metres away from me, Petula. Now, can you imagine, you know, in any sort of a family gathering of four people, and we have a huge lobby here, you know, it's unimaginable to think that 2 metres is potentially something, because it's just not workable, and that's the reality of it. And so we've gone in with a 1 metre, I suppose, based on the WHO guidelines. And this is something that's, you know, in effect in other countries and that as well. And that's our starting point.
Do you imagine waiting staff here will be wearing face masks?
It's not in our recommendations. That doesn't mean to say that government will adopt it. And I suppose if you think about it, where we've asked for the 1 metre WHO guidelines, it is without the expectation of a mask. But equally, you know, government might come back and say, OK, you know, we're with you on the 1 metres. We're willing to give it a try, but it could be under other provisos.
The echo. The hotel normally hosts 3 weddings a week at this time of year, but today the ballroom is empty.
Today it's fairly depressing as we face into an empty room, and you can see, you know, lights off, loads and loads of chairs. It's funny because traditionally our hotel would only be closed on Christmas Day, and we always say it's the eeriest day of the year, you know, but we have so many of these right now. We hosted a wedding on the 13th of March, whereby the cap of 100 was in place. And, you know, the couple were amazing. They'd only 24 hours notice, but the people at the wedding were amazing as well. We never reached a point where we kind of felt we to, you know, give someone the wink or the eye and say, look, you know, you need to step back, or potentially there's too many people or whatever. It never came to that. So I believe we've responsibility to each other. Obviously, we have a responsibility as hotels and as a tourism community in that.
Do you imagine after all of this, and because of putting the measures in place and the expense of putting measures in place, will hotels hotel stays be more expensive?
I hope not, and that's the reality. I think until we've clarity around the guidelines, we won't know. But certainly there is a concern about the cost of, you know, things like sanitizer, or equally in terms of social distancing. And I would say, I would like to imagine things will stay as they are. But what I will say is that government changes in VAT, if there was a reduction in VAT, it'll be wonderful to see, I suppose, because at the end of the day, people often associate VAT and the money as being hoteliers' money. It's not. It's the government taking less. And you're hoping by them taking less as part of their pricing that, I suppose, our guests or our customers will buy something else.
Elena Fitzgerald Kane, President of the Irish Hotels Federation there. Those guidelines proposed by Faoltha Ireland are with the HSE for approval at the moment. In other business news, Lufthansa is to restore some flights next month. I'll have more at 8:30, but for now, back to you, Brian.
Let's see what the weather prospects are for the day and the weekend ahead from Deirdre Lowe at Met Aran. Good morning, Deirdre.
Good morning and thanks. We have some warmer weather on the way for next week, but for this morning, still a cool start. Cloudy skies in many areas, but some sunny spells in the south and southwest. And the best sunshine continuing to be in the southwest through today. Temperatures here up to 17 degrees. Over the rest of the country, a fair deal of cloud, but some brighter sunny spells developing as the day goes on. And temperatures generally around 14 or 15 degrees. So in a lot of places, feeling a bit milder than recently, with light northwest or variable breeze. Though it will be a little cooler with a fresher breeze near the north coast. So tonight, showers will affect coastal parts of Ulster, Connacht and North Munster. It'll be dry elsewhere with some clear spells and a few mist patches forming with a touch of grass frost as temperatures dip to between 2 and 6 degrees with very light winds. So for tomorrow, Saturday morning, this will bring some brighter spells to the east and south. Cloud will increase generally though, with some scattered showers affecting parts of the west and north. And then during the afternoon and evening, rain is likely to move across northern parts of the country, with the south becoming dull but staying mainly dry. Sunday will bring further spells of rain to Ulster, Connacht and also to parts of Munster, but it should hold drier elsewhere with some sunny intervals, and the best temperatures on Sunday will be in Leinster at around 17 or 18 degrees. Monday and Tuesday next, still bringing some occasional light rain or drizzle to places and misty conditions at times near Atlantic coasts, but temperatures will rise to the high teens in any sunny spells inland. And at the moment, it looks dry and pretty sunny for Wednesday next, with temperatures in the high teens or even the low 20s, though southerly breezes keeping it near to the mid-teens near the south coast. But for today, temperatures about 12 to 17 degrees north to south, with a few showers in the north, but mainly dry elsewhere. Very good morning to you.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, May the 15th, and this is Morning Ireland with Brian Dobson and Audrey Carvel. The news is read now by Vivian Traynor.
The Cabinet is expected to sign off today on the first phase of easing COVID-19 restrictions as part of the government's roadmap for reopening society and business. Funding to restart small business is also set to be approved by government today. Our political correspondent Micheál Lehane.
All the indications point to Cabinet giving the green light today to begin the reopening of around 1,500 businesses on Monday. These include homeware stores, garden centres, farmers' markets, bike shops and motor garages, electrical and IT stores and opticians. Golf courses and tennis courts will reopen too on that day. Construction workers and gardeners are also set to be able to return to work on Monday if the Cabinet grants its approval today. And up to four people who don't live in the same household would be allowed to meet up outdoors as long as they maintained a 2 metre distance. Business Minister Heather Humphreys will bring a proposal to Cabinet for a €250 million fund for small firms. It will provide grants of up to €10,000 to assist businesses looking to reopen.
The Minister for Agriculture, Michael Creed, is to face questions in the Dáil next week about an increase of cases of COVID-19 at meat processing plants. The development comes after several TDs raised the issue in the Dáil yesterday, after RTE News revealed another 60 cases had been confirmed at a meat plant in Edenderry in County Offaly. More than 600 meat workers have now contracted the virus, according to authorities. Our agriculture and consumer affairs correspondent, Fran McNulty.
The meat industry says it has been proactive and has made substantial efforts to try and halt the spread of coronavirus. But SIPTU says the problem is made worse by difficulties implementing social distancing, by air circulation systems in factories, and a low-wage, predominantly migrant workforce living in shared accommodation. In one case, Keepak, which has several plants, sent a letter to staff in which the company said it had been informed by Gardaí that some workers were not adhering to social distancing and in some cases were not self-isolating when requested to do so. The company said the news was disappointing. Yesterday, Roscommon TDE Dennis Nocton said the increase in clusters at meat plants called into question both the testing regime and the COVID protection measures been implemented by employers. The TD has secured the agreement of the Dáil Business Committee to bring the Minister for Agriculture, Michael Creed, before the House next week to face questions on how the virus is being dealt with in the meat industry.
A typhoon has hit the Philippines, forcing thousands of people into shelters as the country tries to cope with the coronavirus pandemic. Torrential rain has forced almost 150,000 people to flee their homes. Authorities said they are trying to halve the capacity of shelters and trying to get people to wear masks. However, they said it was difficult in the circumstances. A majority of people in a survey carried out by the Economic and Social Research Institute believe the lifting of COVID-19 restrictions will be slow and gradual. Only a minority of 28% believe life will return to normal by the end of this year. Our economics correspondent Robert Short.
This survey was carried out the week before the government's roadmap for lifting the COVID-19 restrictions was published. However, the ESRI believes it provides a good benchmark for people's opinions and expectations on how life will evolve here under the pandemic. The three restrictions which people considered would have the biggest impact on their lives if lifted were interaction beyond their household, travelling over longer distances, and the opening of non-essential shops and services. Approximately half thought non-essential travel within Ireland would resume by the end of August or before. 38% believed foreign travel wouldn't resume until at least next year, and the most popular response towards opening non-essential shops was the end of June. A clear majority agreed with the view that it would take longer than next year before life went back to normal with no social distancing or cases of coronavirus in Ireland.
The funeral will take place in County Mayo today of the Argentine ambassador to Ireland, Laura Bernal, who died last month. Burial following a funeral mass in Foxford is taking place in accordance with the wishes of her family in recognition of the link between the town and Argentina. Our Western correspondent Pat McGrath.
Laura Bernal was appointed as her country's ambassador to Ireland in early 2016, and in the years that followed she made several visits to Foxford, the birthplace of the founder of the Argentinian Navy, Admiral William Brown. Last November, she led a 200-strong delegation to the town to celebrate the connection between Argentina and County Mayo. On that occasion, the 63-year-old spoke of the warm welcome she'd always received there and expressed her enduring gratitude to the people of Foxford. It's said to be very unusual for the remains of a serving ambassador not to be repatriated to their home country. But due to restrictions as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the wishes of the late diplomat's family, Ms. Bernal will be buried following a funeral mass in County Mayo this afternoon. Pat McGrath, RTE News, Foxford, County Mayo.
Gardaí are investigating a shooting in North Dublin last night in which a man sustained non-life-threatening injuries. The incident was reported in the Marygold Park area of Darndale shortly after 9 o'clock. Gardaí and paramedics arrived at the scene, but the victim had left in a car and presented himself at Beaumont Hospital a short time later with gunshot wounds. Gardaí at Coolock are appealing for witnesses or anyone with information to contact them. And the time now is just after 6 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Centra. Staying close to home is how we all live every day right now. So know that at Centra, we have everything you need.
A few scattered showers today in parts of Ulster and Connacht, where there will be a good deal of cloud overall. It will stay dry further south and east with some bright or sunny spells. Highest temperatures 12 to 17 degrees, mildest in Munster.
Time for It Says in the Papers now with Fiona Kelly.
The report into sexual abuse in scouting, the move to ease us all out of lockdown on both sides of the border from next Monday, and the giant spider-like crab that crawled into the net of a Kerry fisherman are some of the stories which you'll find covered on your front pages this morning. Vulnerable betrayed once again. That's a headline over the lead editorial in today's Irish Examiner. And that paper and the Irish Times also lead this morning with the findings of Ian Elliott's report into sexual abuse in scouting. Both papers highlight its conclusion that sexual abuse was tolerated at the highest levels of former scouting organisations, and that there is evidence that groups of sex offenders operated at the top of those organisations to protect each other and to facilitate child abuse. For its lead story, the Irish Independent outlines details of phase one of the plan to reopen the country, which begins next Monday, which is also the day that Stormont has announced that Northern Ireland will also start easing its restrictions, details of which are covered in the lead story in today's Irish News. The Irish Sun leads with the line that Ireland recorded its lowest COVID-19 reproductive rate yesterday at between 0.4 and 0.6, but that Health Minister Simon Harris says that our biggest test is yet to come when we begin to ease out of lockdown next week. No sun holidays for a month, that's the lead headline in the Irish Daily Mirror, meanwhile, on foot of comments made by the Taoiseach yesterday. And the investigation into whether all hospitals have fully reported cases of COVID-19 after it emerged that one hospital reported hundreds of cases late generates the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mail. In its version of this story, The Times reports that the number of cases accounted for more than half of the 426 new cases reported yesterday, while the Mail puts that number at almost 300. The families of people in care homes in Northern Ireland are threatening legal action unless there is a public inquiry into the handling of the COVID-19 crisis. That's according to the lead story in today's Belfast Telegraph. Restaurateur Ronan Ryan and his wife, former Miss Ireland Pamela Flood, are pictured on the front of The Independent and Herald this morning, with both papers detailing their settlement with Tanager. The Irish Daily Star leads with the story about Ennis barber Hassan Jihad, who came to public attention when he cut John Travolta's hair when he was in Ireland last year, who now admits that he's been cutting hair for friends and family for free during the lockdown. Elsewhere this morning, The Times reports on what it describes as the British Home Office's significant climb down in allowing dairy woman Emma D'Souza to continue to identify as an Irish citizen while allowing her American-born husband Jake to remain living in Northern Ireland. The Mirror reports that Tesco temporarily closed down the clothing section of its store in the Clearwater shopping centre in Finglas this week after customers allegedly refused to obey social distancing, tried on clothes in the aisles, and were abusive towards staff members. The Independent has a nice picture story about Dara Carroll, a chef from Rathfarnham in Dublin, who ended his epic solo journey from Norway on a homemade Viking-style boat at Howth Harbour yesterday. He was greeted by his parents David and Eunice and brother Killian, who were all afraid that he might be refused entry and forced out to sea to quarantine. In the end, however, it was deemed that he had effectively been quarantining since he entered Irish waters 3 weeks ago. And finally, there's an eye-catching picture of a giant crab on the front of today's Mirror. We're told that the extremely rare giant box crab crawled into the nets of fishermen off the coast of Kerry this week. The crab, which usually lives 2 miles below the surface of the water and has a leg span of 6 feet, is now living in a cold water tank in Ocean World in Dingle. Director Kevin Flannery tells Lynn Kelleher that he's hopeful that the crab, which is the only one in the country, will survive. And because of his spider-like appearance, we're also told that staff at Ocean World have nicknamed him Arachnid.
Ministers are expected to sign off today on phase one of the government's plan to reopen the economy and society, more than 2 months after the first restrictions were announced in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic. Around 1,500 businesses will likely get the go-ahead to reopen from Monday, with golf courses and tennis courts also reopening. The expected go-ahead for this initial phase of the plan follows a continuing overall decline in the number of new confirmed cases of the virus, despite a rather startling but apparently unrepresentative increase in the figure reported yesterday. We can find out more from our correspondent Sinead Crowley. Good morning, Sinead.
Good morning.
Now, the figure yesterday for new cases was 426. But Tony Holohan, the chief medical officer, told that news conference last evening that most were accounted for by a batch of accumulated cases which had been reported by one hospital.
That's right. It was a very large figure. We all get those figures, as you know, around usually around 5:30. It was closer to 6:30 yesterday when we got the figures. And the number 426 was a really large jump. We'd been seeing figures of 120, 150, those sort of figures over the last couple of days. So 426 was a huge jump. However, that was clarified at the briefing shortly afterwards, where Dr. Tony Houlihan said that one hospital essentially hadn't been reporting the cases on a daily basis or regularly, and instead reported them altogether in the last week, and that we believe he didn't go into details about where the hospital is or indeed the exact number of cases, but we believe that they're in the region of about 250. So they were all reported together and they all appeared in the figure yesterday. So that made for the 426. So other than that, the figure would have been roughly what would have been expected, and that all feeds into the fact that that Neffet feel that the number of cases is going in the right direction.
And just on those unreported cases, he was asked whether he could say whether there had been tracing following those confirmations.
Yeah, they're going to investigate all of that. I mean, he did say that they only found out those figures quite late on yesterday as well. So they're going to investigate that, talk to the hospital, see what has been going on, make sure obviously it hasn't happened anywhere else, that it's not a pattern. But they did receive, they only received that information, as far as I understand, quite a short time before it was released. So all of that has been looked at.
Right. So leaving that aside then, what is the overall trend in terms of the number of new cases, the number of deaths? We saw further 10 fatalities reported yesterday, and this reproduction rate.
That's right. Thursday is always the day we hear from Professor Philip Nolan, who's involved in modelling, and he gives the reproduction rate of the virus, and that's being described as currently stable. It's between 0.4 and 0.6. And as we heard last week, a 0.5 figure would mean that two people would only pass it to one person and so on. So you can see that it's decreasing. So between 0.4 and 0.6 again this week is seen as very stable. And the other figures that they're looking at are also going down. For example, people in hospital, there was a height at one stage of 865, that yesterday is down to 459. Also, the number of people being admitted to hospital at one stage in mid-April, for example, was between 50 and 60 people. That's down to an average of about 17 at the moment. That's the number of people being admitted to hospital per day. Another figure they look at is the number of people in ICU. That's very significant because a lot of the restrictions were based on could ICU cope and was there capacity. That has fallen down as well. There was at one stage around 140 people. That's down to around 58. And again, people being admitted to ICU was at one stage in mid-April between 8 and 10. That's now between 1 and 2. So they're seen as very positive figures. They're figures that they're looking at as they look at easing restrictions. They're the type of figures clearly that they wanted to see as they gave government advice on what to do next.
Yeah, well now Tony Houlihan declined to say what that advice would be. They had made their determination, I think, by last evening's news conference. But as Micheál Lehane was saying to us earlier, he's certainly expecting that the government will sanction the go-ahead of this first phase of reopening the country. So what will that involve in terms of how things might change come Monday?
That's right. Well, with the emphasis, I suppose, still being on social distancing, and I know people are, you know, looking forward to hopefully restrictions being eased and wanting to find out what they can do. But again, the Neffet briefings, the health briefings, tend to be quite conservative, and they remind you that, look, it's still about protecting people and it's still about social distancing. So an emphasis on social distancing in the easing of restrictions. And you can see that, for example, in the types of shops and places that hopefully will open up there. Places like garden centres, farmers markets, also bike shops and motor mechanics, motor garages, so somewhere like that, that people need to go about their daily business, they'll be able to access them, electrical and IT stores and so on. But you can see there in places like garden centres where there might be a bit of space, there'll certainly be queuing outside. I mean, we can all expect to see queuing and social distancing. People also have been asking about exercise, going out a bit more. They will be able to meet up to four people who don't live in the same household as them, but maintaining a 2 metre distance. And this is outside. Dr. Houlihan mentioned during the week that he didn't want to see, you know, mass gatherings, barbecues, big parties as soon as this, because that's the type of scenes they don't want to see in terms of people meeting up. This is meeting up for somebody you know, or a couple of people, up to four, maybe to go for a walk or to do some exercise outside. There'll also be some sport allowed, but again, the emphasis on a sport where you can distance, so possibly, you know, you can play some tennis or some golf, but you would imagine no, you know, contact sports are going to be approved at this stage. Right. And this is the emphasis being on going out for some exercise. exercising, meeting some people, but not immediately introducing big mass gatherings, because that's the type of scenes they don't want to see.
And the 5K restriction on beyond your home still applies, even if you want to do a play round of golf or a game of tennis.
That's right. Unless you're going to work or you have to go. That's the rule.
Just a word finally, Sinead, about, and it was acknowledged again at that news conference last evening, tensions between NPHET and the health service executive. They would have us believe that that's a fairly healthy part of any relationship between two organisations dealing with this sort of crisis. What do we learn about what relations are like between those two bodies?
That's right. This was a series of letters that were released yesterday between the HSE and NPHET, and they related to testing. Testing has obviously been a huge item of discussion ever since this pandemic began, what the capacity is for testing. And there were letters between the HSE and the Department of Health expressing surprise at capacity and at, I suppose, promises or guarantees made on testing by NPHET, and at briefings that the HSE said they weren't aware of or weren't, you know, in the position to maybe guarantee at that stage. But these were brought up at the briefing yesterday, and what we were told was that, look, there would, you know, everybody is working at pace, everybody is working under pressure. Of course, there would be some tensions. However, Dr. Colm Henry of the HSE is saying that at this stage, we're completely united in our intent and our strategy to fight the virus. And interestingly, yesterday was actually the day the HSE had its briefing about testing, and it is now saying it will deliver that figure of 15,000 per day that people had been looking for. That is due to start from Monday, and a 3-day turnaround on testing as well. So whatever, I suppose, the to and fro where the tensions were, certainly the initial target, that 15K, the 100,000 tests, they are aiming to deliver that on Monday anyway. So that's where that situation is.
Very good, Sinead Crowley. Thank you very much for that. If you have any questions on how the changes which are expected to come into force from Monday might impact on you, on your family, on your business, you can get in touch with us. Our email is coronavirus@rte.ie, and we will try our best to answer your questions in the days ahead.
And we are joined this morning by the Minister for Finance and Public Expenditure, Pascal Donoghue. Minister, good morning.
Good morning, Audrey.
And you're very welcome. So phase one of the reopening expected to take place on Monday. And a central part of that is the return of construction workers to sites across the country, up to 100,000 workers returning to work. Are you satisfied that that is safe?
And when Cabinet makes a decision in relation to this later on today, we will do so because we are confident that there is clarity about guidelines in workplaces, particularly in public construction sites, and also because we believe those guidelines will be implemented and that we will be able to monitor the implementation of them and the impact on public health in the coming weeks. So we believe we can get the balance right. We believe we can get people back to work while at the same time continuing our ongoing efforts to contain this dreadful disease.
Because it's a very high risk industry, because they travel from all across the country. They share accommodation, they share vehicles, they share site huts, they share toilets, they share tools, they share spaces. Subcontractors move between sites. Is it really safe?
You're right to acknowledge the risk, and there is going to be risk in any decision that we make across the coming period. What the Taoiseach and Minister for Health have continually stressed is that we are making decisions and looking to change policy across a time of uncertainty. But Audrey, this is why two points are really important that the government have looked to deliver. The first point is having time to engage with stakeholders in different parts of our country and different parts of our economy so that they understand the risks involved in this and that we can work with them to deal with those risks. And secondly, this is why a phased reopening of our economy and our country is so important, because the very way we can deal with the issues you're correctly identifying is to do this in a phased way with enough time between each phase to understand the impact on public health of decisions that we have previously made.
Yeah, but so phase
to do is get the balance between the risks that you have described there, Audrey, and the other imperatives of the broader health of our society and indeed the ability of an economy to be able to operate again.
Yes, but many will wonder, is this a rushed approach driven by economic concerns? Because phase one was meant to be a phased return of construction workers, yet those in the construction industry have interpreted outdoor work to mean a full return. Everyone is heading back to work on Monday and no one is stopping them.
Well, indeed, much of the debate that I've heard recently has been about comparing the reopening strategy that we have here in Ireland and indeed making the opposite point that our strategy appears quite graduated and cautious versus the paths that other countries are taking. But it is indeed up to each country, to each government and to their public health experts to try to determine what we think is right for their own country. And what we have looked to do is by doing this in a graduated way to manage and balance those risks in the best way possible. So to deal directly with your question, do I believe what we're doing is in any way rushed? I don't. We have used the time between the publication of the roadmap and what's going to happen on Monday to engage intensively with those who are involved in construction. And we will very carefully monitor what happens now across the coming weeks, because of course the health of those who are involved in our construction is of course vital, not only for their own well-being, but also for allowing us to understand the consequences of phase one and the other phases that we're hoping to implement.
Yeah, because we've seen in the UK, men in construction have three times the death rate than men in the health service. Let's talk about the other people then who unfortunately are not able to go back to work from Monday, who have to remain at home like so many of the rest of us as well. And we heard from Retail Excellence Ireland predicting over 100,000 of their members losing their jobs. So many people in dire need. Do you have any news for them this morning, who are dependent on government support to feed their families and pay the bills? I think it's due to run out in 3 weeks' time, that the pandemic unemployment payment and the wage subsidy scheme.
So the two things that I would say to those who are really concerned about the jobs that they have now, that we've managed to keep because of the wage subsidy scheme, and then those who were depending on income because of the pandemic unemployment payment. I want to again recognise the strain and worry that many of them have. I want to assure them that we're going to do what we can to try to keep the jobs that we have and to try to preserve in a careful way people's income as we deal with the terrible effects of this disease. What we are doing at the moment is evaluating what we might be able to afford in the future. And crucially, we want to see what happens when we go ahead with phase one of the economy, what happens with employment levels when we make this decision and across the coming days if Cabinet decides to do so. And then secondly, see if we can better understand the movement between people who are on the pandemic unemployment payment who might then move back onto a wage subsidy scheme. Mm-hmm. Absolutely understand the concern that those have. These are schemes that cost many hundreds of millions of euros per week, and we just want to try and get the balance right.
And for those who can't or won't be able to move from one to the other and who remain in that situation for the next few months, at least until the end of August, perhaps even longer, will that unemployment payment, the pandemic one, be extended until at least the end of phase four?
Well, the government hasn't made the decision in relation to that yet, Audrey, but of course we know we will need to do that soon. When we make that decision, communicate quickly that decision to all who are depending on us. I would very briefly say that the level of intervention that we now have, where we have well over a million of our citizens having their income sustained by the state, is enabled by the great care we've taken in our public finances in recent years. And because of that care, we can now sustain what we're able to do now. And as soon as we understand a little bit more how our economy responds back to the reopening that we hope we're going to be in a position to do, that will allow us to better understand the economic consequences of decisions that we make in relation to those payments. But again, as I talk about the financial and economic issues, which you'd expect me to do, that is centred in an appreciation of the value of these payments and the effect that they're having on families and those who are depending upon them at the moment.
Yeah, because, I mean, can you at least tell them that beyond June the 8th, which is the date which is in print for this payment to be extended until, is it going to go beyond that?
Well, we've indicated on a number of occasions, but myself, the Taoiseach and the Minister for Social Protection, that these payments do definitely have a future. But the nature of that future, how long the payments are going to be sustained for and their level of payment, we will have to make a decision on that in the coming weeks. And as I just noted there a moment ago, because they do cost so much and because we're about to go ahead with the reopening of our economy, we want to see the effect of that reopening first, and then we'll make a decision after that.
Has it been a fairly bad week for the government, in the sense that some commentators saying perhaps things starting to fall apart for you, because we saw your government insisting there was no differences or tensions with NPHET, and now we see clearly that there were. You made an announcement on childcare for healthcare workers. A week later, it was abandoned. The leaving cert was promised it would happen on July 29th, then by hook or by crook, it's been cancelled as well. Are things starting to fall apart a bit?
Oh, well, Audrey, that's always up to your listeners to form a view in relation to what we are doing at the moment. I can simply assure you and those who are listening to your programme this morning that we're working night and day in the midst of a situation that changes by the day, that poses great risk to our country. I couldn't pretend for a moment, nor could anybody in public life, not to mention who's in a government, that we get everything right. But we're doing all we can in the environment that we're in. And in relation to the week that the government has had, it's also a week in which we have seen continued progress in reducing the transmission of the virus. And while every life lost is a life too many, the number of lives that we are being seen lost, which again, everyone is tragic, is significantly below the very worst fears that we legitimately had a number of weeks ago. And I would hope that when you and others are forming an assessment of how this government has performed across this period, a preeminent test will be how we have performed in the face of a pandemic that a number of months ago threatened to wreak such harm on our country. And while, of course, harm has occurred and we've done all we can to reduce that harm, we have seen some progress and important progress in our public health efforts to date.
And just a final question to you. Almost 100 days now with a caretaker government. You're involved in those talks with Fianna Fáil and the Greens. Will we have a government by the end of this month?
I can't guarantee that we will. What I can guarantee is that I and my colleagues in Fine Gael are doing all we can to see if a government is possible. I believe the defining challenge that we will have, in addition to our great public health challenge that we've just discussed now, is our efforts to get people back to work. We now have a level of unemployment that would have been unimaginable a number of weeks ago that's causing such harm this morning. And we have to get our country back to work. We have to get those who never thought they would lose a job again back in a job that respects them and pays them a good income. I believe in order for that to happen, we need to have a government formed that has an affordable and credible programme for government. And myself, Simon Coveney, all the members of our negotiation team are putting our best foot forward to try to do that.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Finance.
Let's take another check on the business headlines once again with Petula Martin. Petula.
Good morning, Brian. Lufthansa plans to resume flights next month. The German airline group will operate 1,800 weekly flights to 130 destinations by the end of June. China's factory output rose by 4% in April as the world's second largest economy slowly emerged from lockdown. Consumers here are more likely to continue shopping online for some goods after COVID restrictions have been lifted, according to research from the Banking and Payment Federation Ireland. But one in five who have shopped online for groceries, hardware and DIY are less likely to shop online for these products once the restrictions are eased. The Financial Times is reporting this morning that London's Canary Wharf has drawn up detailed plans to bring bankers, accountants and lawyers back to the financial district. The plans include introducing one-way routes, daily deep cleaning and limiting the number of people using lifts. On the currencies, €1 buys 88.5 pence sterling and $1 8 cents.
Sport news and a sporting memory again from Darren Frehel. Morning, Darren.
Good morning, Audrey. And some news this morning. The Irish rugby team's tour to Australia has finally been pulled as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. We were expecting this all along, due to take place in July. The fixture, along with all the other international fixtures for the short term, have been postponed by World Rugby. The Dublin ladies football manager Mick Bowen believes the 2020 intercounty season should be scrapped if no vaccine can be found. Now, he feels that players need to be put first, and it's only fair a call should be made sooner rather than later. He was speaking to the Game On team last night.
I think it should be made, and I've said this to people in the LGFA. I think that call should be made very early, because genuinely there's a pressure on players. It hurts me to say it, because it's the elephant in the room. So in my opinion, it doesn't sit well with me even saying it, but I think from a point of release of pressure on everybody, that this thing has to go for 2020.
Now, this time 11 years ago, Shane Lowry was the halfway leader at the Irish Open at Baltrae. He was only 22, an amateur, and playing in his first major event on the European Tour. On the Sunday, he would go on and win the title after a three-hole playoff against Robert Rock. What a magical moment it was.
He expected an amateur after one good round to fall away, as so often happens, but far from fall away. Remarkably comfortable in the position he's in at the top of the leaderboard.
Draws it back, rolls it forward, misses on the left-hand side. He missed it. He puts his head into his hands, pulls the peak of his visor down over his face. He has missed from just outside of 3 feet for the Irish Open. Much too high, way out of reach, but we... He rolls this one forward. It's going to drop. It is a millimetre short of the hole on line. Oh, I can't believe it. Oh, he had the line. I tell you, half a roll more, that ball was in. The hopes we had were much too high, way out of reach, but we have to try. It's about 8 inches. Rolls it forward in the hole. Arms up. Shane Lowry danced on the green. Punches the air. Hugs all around. It is an incredible scene. The green has been invaded here. But Shane Lowry has come from nowhere. And Shane Lowry, incredibly, has won the Irish Open.
Speechless, to be honest. Thought I missed my chance when I missed that short putt and in normal playing, I can't believe what's after happening to me. Life changing, you know. Sure, I'm gonna have a busy week ahead of me this week.
Well, he had a busy 11 years ahead. Shane Lowry there. What a wonderful moment that was. Shane will join the Sunday Sport team this weekend on RT Radio 1. I'll be back on Monday.
We look forward to that. Thanks so much indeed, Darren. Now, Monday we'll see some easing in the COVID-19 restrictions, we expect, introduced by the government as phase one of its roadmap to reopen the country. Businesses, including garden centres and hardware stores, if the change is approved, will be able to reopen their doors to the public. And sports locations, such as tennis clubs and golf clubs, can also open their doors. Well, now, while this is welcome, concerns remain about social distancing. Our reporter Jenny O'Sullivan has been to Cove in East Cork to see how this will impact on the East Cork tourist town.
Ringing out the passage of time in quarter hours, the bells of St. Colman's Cathedral in Cove are a constant, but the streets below are quiet. Out on the water, one of the few ships in the harbour, the Petronas, is making its weekly trip to ring a skiddy. But the town's deep water berth, which was due to welcome some 100 liners and over 240,000 visitors to Cove this year, is quiet and will remain so for the foreseeable future. Up on Harbour Row, the Hallahan brothers, Dave and Shane, who run the hardware house, are taking delivery of some paint. Sure, working behind closed doors, it's been a hectic 2 months and a sharp learning curve, according to Dave.
I suppose we've been kind of learning on our feet, really. It is a whole different business model and we had to feel our way through it. So over the lockdown period, we averaged probably between 60 and 70 deliveries per day. So we would take phone calls from 10 a.m. till 1 a.m. and emails, work through them, complete the orders, and then deliver them in the afternoon or into the early night.
And what are your days like now?
Days are long, you know, they're 12, 14 hour days really, which we don't mind because we're working for ourselves. It's still the same at the moment, the email orders and the telephone from 10 until 1 and delivering it in the afternoon. I suppose with the lockdown and the restrictions in the areas, we've gained an awful lot of new customers as well within the Cove area who in the future we'd like to keep hold of, you know, and keep them on the island shopping locally as much as possible.
Given the continuing need for social distancing, his brother Shane admits they're a little apprehensive about reopening the shop, but they'll be adhering strictly to the guidelines.
I suppose there's still a fear there as to, you know, will we get another spike in the virus and whatnot. And it's just mainly, it's trying to control people, you know, and when I say control people, I just mean as in keep everybody safe.
Without the support to local businesses over the past few weeks, plant and flower wholesaler Hendrik Verwey says his business would have struggled. Today, he's busy filling the first of several orders for garden centres, also reopening on Monday.
So what happened here was, I suppose, in Cove, the local Super Value, which I always supplied, but the actual sales there rocketed through the roof. And a local coal merchant, Tony O'Shea, who always sold bedding plants as well as his coal and his bottled gas and the whole lot, his sales started rocketing through the roof. So people were buying literally anything that was green with a root on it inside in a pot or a little tray. People just went mad for plants, and there was a huge amount of plants bought in a very short amount of time. And that has actually led to a little bit of a blip in the supply situation. But we have plenty of plants for sale, and we're looking forward to next week. We're busy as it is, but next week I suppose we'll be that little bit busier.
Back on the waterfront, chef and owner of the Sea Salt Cafe in Delhi, Jackie O'Dea, has put a new sign in her window, open for takeaways Thursday to Saturday.
But yeah, it's challenging because until there's a vaccine, it seems we're not going to be able to sit anybody more than about six people in here at any given time. So that's probably 18 months into the future of takeaway. So yeah, it's a real learning. For me as a chef, it's quite creative. We'll get there. You know, there's no question about it. We'll get there. We have to get there. This is our livelihood.
At the country's oldest lawn tennis and croquet club at Rushbrook, they're getting ready to reopen on Monday too. Those who want to play, though, will have to adhere to very strict conditions, says club president Eddie Ronayne.
So what in effect it will be is that players will only be allowed to play singles. They'll have to book all their slots online. They'll be given a maximum of an hour and 15 minutes. And then literally you'll be waiting in your car for your slot to become available. But we're lucky that tennis courts and croquet lawns are so big, there's adequate social distancing.
And would you say it's worth it because at least you're getting back out?
I think it's more than worth it because you can imagine we're all dying to get out. Physical exercise is badly needed, and just from the mental health. And I'm actually conscious, I spoke to a couple of members today, we have a lot of frontline workers in the club who need that bit of headspace, I think, to get out and have a game of tennis and just tune out from the stress of the current situation.
And that report from Cove in Cork Harbour, from Jenny O'Sullivan.
Well, this has been a very stressful time for all of us, but imagine the anxiety involved for healthcare workers and their families. Staff on the front line account for almost one in every three COVID-19 cases here. Seven of them have died. Fiacre O'Kioni reports now on how healthcare staff are dealing with these very tough times.
A secondary school in the east of the country is to close for 14 days after the first case of the COVID-19 coronavirus.
The country faces weeks of widespread disruption as the Taoiseach today announced a series of measures to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
Together we can slow the virus in its tracks and push it back.
212 new cases of the virus. 26 more deaths.
A further 34 deaths. 44 more people have died.
1,319 people have lost their lives.
For many of us, the heart-racing fear of COVID-19 may feel never-ending. But for those keeping us safe, that fear is a constant reality. Since the pandemic began, health service workers have been putting their lives at risk so we don't have to. Dr. Rita Doyle, Medical Council President, says it means they are being pushed to their limit.
I think this is an extraordinarily stressful time for medics. They are dealing and caring for patients in a very different way to the way they normally do. The stress levels are extraordinarily high at the moment. You're putting yourself at risk as well as caring for the patient. Doctors have an ethical responsibility to look after their own health. If the doctor gets sick, they're of no benefit to their patient.
Almost one in every three COVID-19 cases involves a healthcare worker, putting staff under additional strain. Denise Hartigan is clinical nurse manager at Connolly Hospital's COVID unit. She says the pressure has been unprecedented.
For me, as a nurse, I'm used to coping with tragedy. I'm used to coping with people's lives being turned upside down, being ripped apart. But this was on a whole new level. I felt that every day I didn't know what I was going to face. Every hour it was changing. Nurses are normally tactile. All of a sudden we were going in full PPE, looking like creatures from outer space. I still remember those first few days. I didn't sleep. I was scared for myself. I was scared for my staff. I was nervous for my patients. It was so scary. As the manager of the unit, I felt that I had to project this image of, you know, control and calmness. When I came home, I mean, even coming home was a pressure. You're so worried coming into your own home. That is a fear that every nurse, healthcare assistant had, that unless you're actually involved in, you actually don't know what it's like.
In addition to fighting the virus, medics on the front line must also fight their fears for themselves, their patients and their families. Dr. Paddy Hillary is the Irish Medical Organisation's NCHD committee chair and a special registrar at University Hospital Limerick.
The experience that we've all been through as a whole tends to be one of facing into the unknown. This was a potentially devastating disease that was coming at pandemic levels. We're used to a significant level of stress. What we're not used to is a situation where not only is the patient coming in the door unwell themselves, but there's a large probability if they are extremely unwell and we don't prepare correctly, we can cause infection to our staff, our colleagues, our family and ourselves. We're looking at the prospect of a life in PPE.
For health service workers who are struggling, supports are available from the HSE, Medical Council and individual hospitals. Among those supports is the Practitioners Health Matters Group, chaired by Dublin GP Dr. Ida DeLargy.
We recognise that there will be additional anxieties that go along with the stresses of the COVID work. As well, then, there can be additional pressures at this time that frontline workers are experiencing.
Many of those challenges are similar to those faced by the general public. Fergal Rooney is head of psychology at St. John of God's Hospital. He says 50% of his patients in the past month have had COVID-19 worries, including doctors.
I don't think there's actually a person in Ireland today who hasn't some psychological pressure or stress arising from COVID and managing it. We did a review of our admission cohort for the last month. 50% of the admissions in the last month have been directly linked to a COVID difficulty that people have encountered. We saw that we had quite a cohort of people from nursing, medical backgrounds. These kinds of issues do cause deep and profound stress for people.
This deep and profound stress, as Fergal Rooney says, has affected everyone in Ireland. Despite their training, doctors and nurses are not immune, as Medical Council President Dr. Rita Doyle is the first to acknowledge.
My own daughter is a nurse, contacted COVID. I will never forget on a Saturday afternoon doing a FaceTime call with my daughter and seeing how ill she was and saying, oh my God, as a doctor, I am terrified that when we start to unwind the lockdown, we won't take enough care as a society. I walk in the middle of the road in front of a car rather than walk too close to somebody. So staying away from each other is what will keep the doctors and the nurses and the healthcare workers well and safe.
Dr. Rita Doyle ending that report from Fiacra O'Kioni.
A Derry woman, Emma D'Souza, is this morning celebrating a remarkable victory in a long-running battle with Britain's Home Office over recognition of her Irish and EU citizenship. She's forced a change in UK immigration law, which means that all people born in Northern Ireland will be treated as EU citizens for immigration purposes after Brexit. Emma and her husband Jake, who was born in the United States, had waged a four-year legal struggle with the backing of the Irish government to vindicate rights enshrined in the Good Friday Agreement. And we can talk now to Emma. Very good morning to you, Emma, and thanks for taking our call this morning.
Now, good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
You didn't, I think it's fair to say, set out to change the law. This arose when you and Jake went to immigration authorities to try and secure his residency documents as a US citizen married to you. What happened then?
That's correct. We never intended or set out to have a four-year legal challenge, certainly. We just simply decided that we wanted to live in Northern Ireland and went through the process of getting his EU residence permit. And I applied on the basis of my Irish citizenship because I hold only an Irish passport and identify as Irish, as is my right under the Good Friday Agreement. However, that application was initially refused by the Home Office, who said that I was automatically a British citizen, having been born in Northern Ireland, and who advised me that if I wanted to be accepted as Irish for the purposes of immigration, I would have to first renounce British citizenship, which of course then started our four-year legal battle where I contended that I identify as Irish and under the Good Friday Agreement should be accepted as such.
So your argument, if I understand it, was that you didn't have to renounce British citizenship because you weren't a British citizen in the first place. You exercised your right under the Good Friday Agreement to identify as Irish.
That's it, Brian. And we are delighted to see change come through today that now, at long last, 20-odd years after the Good Friday Agreement, recognises the Good Friday Agreement birthright to be accepted as Irish or British or both, with the Home Office now bringing immigration laws in line with that commitment under the Good Friday Agreement. Previous to this, people would have to either renounce British citizenship or apply as British, and that was something that I wasn't willing to do.
But this took 4 years, backwards and forwards, presumably, arguments going in both directions, and it took that long for the British government to accept what I think everybody accepts now is its obligations at the outset.
Yeah, it was a difficult 4 years for us as a family. It certainly framed the first 4 years of our marriage. But today, seeing the impact that these changes will have, and personally knowing families that have been separated for, you know, the guts of 18 months where they haven't seen each other and they will now be reunited, seeing a change that will ensure that no other family has to go through what we went through and that no one will have to renounce British citizenship in order to access rights. When you see that happen, it really does feel like it was worth it.
And from Jake's point of view, he will have residency rights here, married to an EU citizen, so he'll be able to move freely throughout the European Union, which I presume might well have been the case if it had been done through the UK system.
That's it. Now we've actually managed to secure a right where all British and Irish citizens born in Northern Ireland will be treated as EU citizens for immigration purposes and now can bring in their family members under the EU regulations, which is a massive change that will benefit not just those in Northern Ireland, but many of their family members as well.
Right. So a huge relief for you. The news came through yesterday, did it, Emma?
It did indeed. I had a little bit of a heads up from the Department of Foreign Affairs, who've been working very closely with us on this. And it really was quite a day for us yesterday. Unexpected.
All right.
And we're absolutely thrilled and delighted to be getting change.
All right. Well, and reason to celebrate when at the moment there perhaps isn't a whole lot to be celebrating about.
Absolutely.
All right. Emma D'Souza, thanks so much indeed for talking to us. We appreciate your time this morning. It's just a minute to nine.